This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, February 3rd, 2009. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Auda Bogado. Tom Daschle withdraws from consideration for Secretary of Health and Human Services. The move comes amidst growing criticism over his failure to pay $140,000 in taxes. Eric Holder gets sworn in as Attorney General. We'll take a look at what kind of Justice Department he's inheriting and what he might do about it. The situation is worsening in Pakistan's tribal regions. As Barack Obama sends more troops to neighboring Afghanistan, armed men kidnap a regional UN official out of his own office. Those stories and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The president of Kyrgyzstan has ordered the U.S. to close its airbase there. The Manas airbase is a major military support hub and could have substantial impact on U.S. and NATO operations in Afghanistan. President Kurmanbek Bakiev said the decision was made because Washington refused to compensate them adequately. The announcement came just after Russia pledged billions of dollars in aid to Kyrgyzstan. The EU may launch a complaint with the World Trade Organization over the U.S. administration's Buy American clause in the $800 billion economic recovery package now before Congress. The clause would ensure that only U.S. iron, steel, and manufactured goods are used in construction work funded by the bill. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Governments around the world hit hard by the collapse of their largely deregulated financial systems have been worrying for a while that this crisis will encourage protectionism and further limit free trade. If this Buy American clause is approved, they say it could trigger retaliatory moves that will slow global recovery. But fair trade campaigners have pointed out that it's protectionism that enabled the EU and the US to prosper in the past, at great cost to poorer countries. Free trade for them has usually meant allowing wealthy nations to monopolise their resources and markets. The White House has said it's reviewing the Buy American part of the stimulus bill. And according to Germany's Premier Angela Merkel, President Obama promised her that the US will not pursue protectionist policies. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The US-led coalition in Iraq has started freeing 50 detainees a day in accordance with the US-Iraqi security agreement that took effect January 1st. The military will release a total of 1,500 detainees a month. Some 15,000 people are currently in custody. Colombian rebels freed another hostage today. Former Governor Alan Jara, who was held for more than 7 years, became the fifth hostage released this week. Police have charged a New York teen, who was already accused of stabbing an Ecuadorian to death, with 7 more attacks on Latino immigrants. Free Speech Radio News' Christopher Rios has more.
17-year-old Jeffrey Conroy is charged with delivering the fatal blow in an attack on Ecuadorian immigrant Marcelo Lucero last November. Now, police have charged him with 7 other attacks in Patchogue, Long Island. Today, Conroy pleaded not guilty to the new charges. Since the attack on Lucero, members of the immigrant community have come forth with stories of numerous other attacks on Long Island. And over the weekend, an LGBT center's outreach van in the area had its windows broken and tires slashed. The rise in hate crimes has led community activists to push for legislation that requires police on Long Island to keep better track of such attacks. Today, immigrant, labor, and LGBT activists spoke in favor of the bill. Luis Valenzuela spoke in favor of the measure.
Hate crimes are not isolated incidents, even though it may be that individuals commit them. The effect of a hate crime is to send a message. It is a terroristic message that gets sent out to the community.
Lawmakers will act on the measure today. If the bill passes, a task force will be created dedicated to addressing bias and hate crimes. From New York, I'm Christopher Rios with the Community News Production Institute.
And in West Palm Beach, Florida, yesterday, 2 environmentalists were sentenced to jail for protesting the construction of a new natural gas-fired power plant. 5 others received probation. WMNF's Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Last February, activists engaged in an act of civil disobedience in front of the planned West County Energy Center, which, when constructed, will be the largest fossil fuel power plant in the country. The activists want Florida Power and Light to produce an environmental impact study on what the effects could be on the air and water supply. 27 people were arrested, and ultimately 7 went to trial in December. On Monday, 2 of them were ordered jailed for 1 and 2 months respectively, while 5 others received 8 years probation. Kara Jennings is an activist and city commissioner in Lake Worth, Florida. She thinks giving jail time for civil disobedience is designed to slow down the protests.
I think the intention is to have a chilling effect. The charges against these activists are misdemeanors. There was no property damage, no harm caused to an officer. It was a very calm protest. So to take that type of scenario and allow it to equate jail time for activists, I think that will definitely discourage other people from participating.
Those sentenced could also face fines as much as $21,000 apiece. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
It's been a tough day for presidential nominations in Washington. President Barack Obama's pick for chief performance officer for the government, Nancy Killefer, withdrew her name amidst allegations she'd failed to pay unemployment tax. Just over an hour later, Tom Daschle withdrew from consideration for Secretary of Health and Human Services. He's been drawing fire for his own tax problems. Obama Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said that Daschle withdrew on his own accord.
The important work that the president does on those agenda items continues here today. They realize that agenda and the president's call for change was more important and did not want to be a distraction.
Word spread like wildfire on Capitol Hill. Many Democrats expressed regret at the decision. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts.
We're getting silly here, and I think that people ought to step back and just measure these things against the larger picture.
Given the large Democratic majority in the Senate, Daschle likely would have won confirmation, but Republicans became increasingly outspoken in their criticism, and today several major newspapers joined their calls for Daschle to withdraw. Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss of Georgia.
You know, they say they wanted to change the way Washington does business, and yet they appoint lobbyists to positions, and you have individuals who have these issues of not paying their taxes, not once, not one situation, not two, but now I understand there's a third one. And that's not much in the way of change.
The Obama administration is now looking for a replacement for Daschle. Meanwhile, President Obama has nominated Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire for the position of Commerce Secretary. He would be the third Republican to join Obama's cabinet and also the third senator. So, yet again, a state governor will get to appoint a new senator who hasn't had to go through an actual election. After the Blagojevich scandal in Illinois, that's a process some reformers are hoping to change, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Senator Judd Gregg sits as the top Republican on the powerful Budget Committee. Gregg is known on Capitol Hill as a fiscal conservative. The third-term senator is a Republican from the early primary state of New Hampshire. President Obama made the announcement Tuesday morning.
Now, clearly, Judd and I don't agree on every issue, most notably who should have won the election. But we do agree on the urgent need to get American businesses and families back on their feet. We see eye to eye on conducting the nation's business in a responsible, transparent, and accountable manner.
If confirmed, Gregg will be plucked from his Senate seat into the executive. With Republicans only numbering 41 in the 100-person Senate, Gregg was valuable. But Senator Gregg confirmed that New Hampshire's Democratic Governor John Lynch will appoint a Republican to fill his seat so Democrats don't reach the coveted 60-seat supermajority, a number that makes it easier to defeat Republican objections.
And I also want to thank the governor of New Hampshire for his courtesy and courage in being willing to make this possible through the agreement that we have relative to my successor in the Senate.
Gregg's successor will be his former chief of staff, Bonnie Newman. Newman promised she will not run for re-election in 2010. Including President Obama and Vice President Biden, five senators will have vacated the Senate for the executive branch. All five senators came from states where the governor appoints a replacement. That means 5% of the Senate has been selected, not elected. In each case, the appointments have been controversial. First, the apparent behind-the-scenes deal-making with the New Hampshire governor over Gregg's replacement. Then there's Illinois' Roland Burris. His appointment was tainted by disgraced Governor Rod Blagojevich. In New York, the governor replaced Hillary Clinton with Kirsten Gillibrand, a Congress member from upstate New York with conservative views on gun rights, immigration, and the economy, views that don't fit in line with many Democrats. Like in the New Hampshire case, the other two Senate seats were filled with people who have never been elected for public office. Colorado's Michael Bennett, to replace Ken Salazar, who is now Interior Secretary, was head of Denver Public Schools. Joe Biden's Delaware seat went to his former Chief of Staff, Ted Kaufman, who is considered a placeholder until Joe Biden's son returns from Iraq. Mary Boyle is with the government watchdog group Common Cause.
It puts a tremendous amount of power into the hands of one person, that being the governor. And the second is it denies the state, a vote on a very important position of representation.
The population in the five states totals 39 million people, about 15% of the U.S. population, who have now not chosen their representative. Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, is trying to change that.
These are probably going to be excellent senators, but it ultimately is not a good thing to not have people who are not directly elected by the people. They will have to face election, but I think everybody should have a chance to vote for a senator.
Feingold has introduced a measure in the Senate that would amend the Constitution to take the power from the governor and institute a special election. Feingold's state of Wisconsin is one state that already does so.
Wisconsin's had a good system. We've always elected senators and House members. That's the way it ought to be.
It's a notion that has sparked some interest in Washington on both sides of the aisle. Republican Senator John McCain, who is a man of few words these days, has signed on to Feingold's measure.
I think it's a real good idea.
There are critics, and some point to the cost of special elections. The idea was floated to fill Illinois' seat, but it went nowhere in part because of the cost of holding an election. And amending the Constitution is not an easy process. Feingold's bill would need two-thirds support of both houses of Congress and ratification by three-quarters of the state legislatures. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Eric Holder got sworn in as Attorney General today. He's the first African-American to hold that position, and he's inheriting a department that's been plagued by scandal and controversy under the Bush administration. The Department of Justice has been accused of pursuing prosecutions for political reasons, dismissing attorneys who wouldn't toe the administration's line, signing off on torture of terror suspects, and much more. So, what will Holder do? Where will he start? And what might he leave intact? Joining me to discuss what's ahead for Eric Holder is Doug Castle, director of the Notre Dame Law School Center for Civil and Human Rights. Doug, welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
What do you think the top priorities are going to be for Eric Holder?
In terms of concrete substantive issues, there's a whole cluster of them revolving around the violations of law and violations of human rights by Bush administration officials committed during the so-called war on terrorism. And the broad question is, does the Attorney General launch criminal investigations with an eye toward prosecuting a number of high-ranking Bush administration officials, or is some other approach considered to be preferable, such as congressional investigations or the creation of some sort of truth commission?
Barack Obama's approach so far has not been particularly oriented towards recriminations for things that happened in the past. Do you think it's important to prosecute people who were involved in those issues?
I think it's important to conduct investigations of people who, as to whom there is reasonable suspicion that they may have committed crimes, especially if they are high-ranking officials. The kinds of crimes that were committed, torturing people, violating the fundamental requirements of the Geneva Conventions for fair trials, holding people endlessly in inhumane conditions at Guantanamo, are so serious that you cannot simply sweep them under the rug. And so, in my judgment, a careful look should be taken by the Justice Department at the pros and cons of prosecuting in those individual cases. Now, that doesn't mean that at the end of the day there will in fact be prosecutions, or many of them, because many of the officials will claim, and some of them will certainly be justified in making this claim, that they relied on legal opinions given out by the Bush Justice Department, in particular the famous John Yoo memos that came from the Office of Legal Counsel. And I would agree with the statements that Attorney General Holder made during his confirmation process that where it is shown that a potential defendant relied in good faith on a legal opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department, it would not be fair or proper to prosecute that individual.
In terms of the encroachments on civil liberties we've seen in the past 8 years, the warrantless wiretapping, secret prisons, torture, do you think the Obama administration will back away from all of them, or are there some it might want to keep on its toolkit?
I think they'll back away from most of them, but back away is probably a good phrase because it doesn't mean reject entirely. For example, in the new executive order subjecting the CIA to the same limits on techniques to which the military is subjected in the Army Field Manual, there is a sort of an escape clause where in certain circumstances it might be authorized that techniques could be used by the CIA which can't be used by the military. On the other hand, I think the general thrust of what they do will certainly be moving much closer to where we were before the Bush people came in. One area where I think that's not likely to be true is with regard to warrantless wiretapping. I think that the Obama administration is likely to maintain, as Congress already has, the broadened authority of the U.S. government to wiretap telecommunication without judicial warrants.
Well, Doug Castle, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Doug Castle is director of Notre Dame Law School's Center for Civil and Human Rights. President Obama has ordered 3 more combat brigades to Afghanistan, where the situation is worsening for the U.S.-backed government. Yesterday in southern Afghanistan, a suicide bomber detonated a powerful explosive device in a police camp, killing at least 21 officers. Across the border in Pakistan's Balochistan province, armed men have kidnapped the head of the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees Office. FSRN's Aphrodite Afridi is there.
In Pakistan, it has become a ritual now. First, a tragedy that would grab international headline, like abductions or bombings, followed by security forces blocking roads and carrying out searches. Yesterday, Quetta witnessed this ritual once again. John Selecki, an American who has been heading the UN High Commissioner for Refugees office in Quetta, was ambushed and kidnapped by armed men when he was driven to work. Ishrat Rizvi, National Information Officer at the UN Information Center in Islamabad, spoke to FSRN.
Soliski was going to his office when this incident happened. A gunman, a group of people stopped the vehicle and opened the firing on the vehicle, and the driver was shot. And later on, Mr. Soliski was abducted by the attackers. And the United Nations strongly condemned this attack on humanitarian workers in Pakistan who have been doing their utmost to deliver their humanitarian mission. Now the United Nations is closely coordinating with the government authorities to secure the release of Mr. Soliki.
Do you think it is because that Mr. Soliki is American national, or just it is an attack on humanitarian workers in Quetta?
You know, such type of incidents happened in past, and it happens everywhere. And Quetta is one of the area which, you know, in Pakistan, where such incidents already happened in past. And perhaps on the international community, or maybe it happened with the other officials as well. It happened with Pakistani officials. It happened with the other international officials as well.
UNHCR runs a major international humanitarian effort in the region, attending to the needs of the officially recognized 500,000 refugees. Fiz Kakkar is John Sulecki's colleague at the UN mission in Quetta, but works at the UNDP office.
There was already less mobility for international staff, and with the abduction of Sulecki, our movement could be reduced even further. It is also a big blow to a country which had to take a huge loan from the IMF just to pay the salaries of government workers. There has been very little effort to develop our province other than what's been initiated by international organizations. So if they decide to reduce even these operations, it will be a big blow to this poverty-stricken area.
John Sulecki's kidnap would not only harm the refugees' interests, but also the relief efforts in the earthquake-affected areas in Ziyarat, only 80 miles from Quetta. Fateh Shah is working as an emergency coordinator with a Balochistan Rural Support Program, BRSP, in Ziyarat.
Life has been hell since the recent earthquake in Balochistan. The government did very little to provide the earthquake victims with needs like shelter. It was the international organizations that did most of the job. If the government doesn't release the abducted officer, I doubt the international organizations will continue their work here.
Balochistan, bordering Afghanistan, is close to Kandahar, the stronghold of Taliban. Nationalist groups asking for self-determination of Balochistan also operates in this region. Today, the security officials detained several suspects in connection with John Soliki's kidnapping. Pakistan authorities claim they are in an all-out effort to track him down. So far, the most high-profile Western abduction in Pakistan since U.S. journalist Daniel Pearl. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Afridai Afridi.
In Gaza, residents are rebuilding the tunnels to Egypt that were destroyed by Israeli bombing last month. Israel says Hamas uses the tunnels to smuggle weapons into Gaza. But in the face of a devastating 20-month-long economic blockade, residents have also used the tunnels to smuggle in everything from food to medicine. FSRN's Rami El-Megari has more.
In southern Gaza, trade continues in the tunnels near the Rafah crossing, despite repeated Israeli attacks on many of those tunnels. Tuesday, the Israeli army warned people in the area, apparently ahead of one more bombardment. In the Barazil neighborhood, a tunnel that was destroyed by Israeli warplanes 10 days ago is being reconstructed now, along with dozens of others, on the borderline. Ahmed is a tunnel worker and father of six children.
I have no choice but to do this. Who gives me money? No one. Therefore, I must continue working. I'm not satisfied with this at all. When I walk out of my home in the morning, I say bye to my family knowing I might not come back.
Inside the coastal territory, more than 1.5 million residents still suffer from a lack of essential goods and commodities such as food items, fuel and raw materials. Many such goods are being brought from Egypt through the underground tunnels. Yusri Daban is a Gaza station owner in the middle area of Gaza Strip. He describes the situation as hundreds of people line up to get their share of cooking gas.
The problem does not lie in me, brother. The problem lies on the Israeli side, which is supposed to provide the Gaza Strip with 350 tons of gas on daily basis. Currently, they only provide us with 80 or 90 or 120 tons, and these quantities are not enough. In my station, I have customers who have been waiting for 3 days.
Other Gaza-based armed factions, such as the Islamic Jihadi Group, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Popular Resistance Committees, called for continuing attacks against Israel, unless Israel reopens all border crossings. On Tuesday, a Russian-made Grad rocket landed in a nearby Israeli area, with no casualties reported. Hamas negotiators in Cairo recently rebuffed an Israeli ceasefire proposal. Israeli officials wanted Hamas to release a captured Israeli soldier, but Hamas says a ceasefire should include an Israeli reopening of all Gaza's border crossings. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Megari on the Gaza-Egypt borderline.
Sri Lanka's military says it has captured the last remaining airstrip controlled by Tamil Tiger rebels. In recent months, government troops have routed the separatist group from much of its territory. The rebellion is now confined to a small coastal area surrounded by the army and navy. But there are also some 250,000 civilians trapped with the rebels and caught in the crossfire. As government forces bring the 25-year civil war to a bloody close, Sri Lankans are protesting about how it's bankrolling its efforts. Despite the recent drop in oil prices, the country's government is not passing on the savings to its citizens, keeping prices artificially high, with taxes totaling more than 200%. From Colombo, Anne Raber files this report.
There are two sights that let you know you're in a certain part of Asia. When a motorized rickshaw rolls by, or a family of four pulls up to a traffic light on a motorbike. Called tuk-tuks or trishaws, these colorful three-wheeled vehicles in Sri Lanka serve as family cars or delivery trucks, heaped with vegetables, boxes, or even furniture. Nimal has been shuttling people around Colombo in a tuk-tuk for 10 years. He was airing up his tires at a petrol station this week in between fares.
1 liter, so 120. Now very high now.
While the market price is only about 30 rupees per liter, Nimal pays 120 rupees, four times the market value, to fill up. In other words, Sri Lankans, whose GDP is 200 times less than the United States, pay about twice as much as Americans for gas, $4.25 a gallon.
I know.
But that is a huge improvement, says Nimal, who paid over $6 when the prices were at their peak.
I'm Asanta Siriman, chief editor of Lanka Business Online.
Asanta Siriman has been writing about consumer economics in Sri Lanka for over 10 years.
Sri Lanka has had a history of overpricing petrol and underpricing diesel. Originally, the logic behind that was that diesel was used for mass transportation, for buses, trucks, and people who were like general richer who had cars for private transport that they were going to tax. And there was a time in the 90s when Sri Lankan diesel was 13 rupees and petrol 50 rupees. But what happened during that time was a lot of people shifted from using petrol-driven cars to diesel-driven vans. And they were effectively evading the tax on transport. The government gives tax-free coupons to parliamentarians, for example, with all kinds of politicians. And some people, like people who use small cars, three-wheelers and also motorcycles, are getting taxed very, very heavily. So there's a question of social justice here.
Opposition groups and drivers have been demonstrating in Colombo, demanding that the government lower the price of petrol, as it was recently ordered to do by the Supreme Court. But the government says it cannot lower the tax because the revenue goes to funding the war against the Tamil Tigers in the north of the country. Provincial Councilman Shawal Hamid Mohammed represents the Western Province.
And the government suppressing all the problems, that the cost of living problems of the people by showing the war. We know very well that war is done on a political angle to cheat the innocent Sinhala Buddhist people who are very much emotionally upset about this problem in the north.
Government supporters call those who oppose the high petrol tax anti-government conspirators and say that they are unpatriotic and not supportive of the war against the Tamil Tigers. The government is refusing to comply with the Supreme Court order to lower the cost of petrol, and the space for political dissent in Sri Lanka is decreasing, given the attacks on two independent press outlets last week. The average monthly income of a Sri Lankan family is about $230. The country also shows dangerously high inflation figures. Even if the government claimed to have won the war against the Tamil Tigers, foreign investment is still at bay, and the tax on petrol brings quick money for the government, that too at 200%. For Free Speech Radio News in Colombo, I'm Anne Raber.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Catherine Kopp and Vinod K. Joes produced today's broadcast. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our headlines editors are Jess Burns and Nell Abram. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, go to our website, www.fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Auto Bogato.